Let the cellular work, he prayed, speaking to a god he had made fun of for most of his creative life. Please let the damn phone work, God, and please let Steve have his ears on. Then, realizing all of that was getting the cart quite a bit ahead of the horse, he added a third request. Please give me a chance to use the phone in the first place, okay? As if in answer to this part of his prayer, the big cop passed the driver's door of his cruiser without even looking at it and walked to Johnny's motorcycle. He put Johnny's helmet on his own head, then swung one leg over the seat. He was very tall, so it was actually more of a step than a swing, and a moment later the Harley's engine exploded into life. Moving cautiously to start with, the cop descended the side of the road. Once he was on the desert floor, he accelerated, changing rapidly up through the gears and weaving around clumps of sagebrush. Run into a gopher hole, you sadistic fuck, Johnny thought, sniffing gingerly through his plugged and throbbing nose. Hit something hard, crash and burn. Don't waste your time on him, he mumbled, and used his thumb to pop the snap over the right breast pocket of his motorcycle jacket. He took out the Motorola cellular phone. The cellulars had been Bill Harris's idea, maybe the only good idea his agent had had in the last 4 years, and flipped it open. He stared down at the display, breath held, now praying for an S and two bars. The phone beeped. What came up in the window on the left side of the display was an S, which stood for service, and one bar. No, please, he moaned. Please don't do this to me. Just one more, please. He shook the phone in frustration and saw he had neglected to pull up the antenna. He did, and a second bar appeared above the first. It flickered, went out, then reappeared, still flickery, but there. Yes, Johnny whispered. Yes! He jerked his head up and stared out the window. The cop had brought the Softail to a stop about 300 yards out in the scree. He stepped off and then stepped away, letting the bike fall over. The engine died. You crazy shit, Johnny whispered. He snuffled back half-congealed blood, spat a jellied wad of it onto the cruiser's paper-littered floor, and looked down at the telephone again. On the row of buttons at the bottom, second from the right, was the one which read, Name Menu. Johnny punched the button, and his agent's first name appeared in the window. Bill. Pushed it again, and Terry appeared. Dear God, why had he put all these people ahead of Steve Ames? Steve was his lifeline. He punched the Name Menu button again, and Steve appeared. He dropped his thumb onto the Send button and squeezed it. Then he held a phone to his ear, bending over to the right and peering out of the bottom of the window as he did so. The cop was kicking sand over the Harley's engine block. The phone began to ring in Johnny's ear, but he knew he wasn't home free yet. He had tapped into the roamer network, that was all. He was still a step away from Steve Ames. Come on, come on, come on! The phone stopped ringing. There was a click. Welcome to the Western Roaming Network, a cheery robot voice said. Your call is being routed. Thank you for your patience, and have a nice day. Never mind the 70s shit, just hurry the fuck up, Johnny whispered. In his ear, the telephone began to ring, and this time, the sound was scratchy and distant. Down in the desert, the cop went on kicking and kicking, burying the handlebars of Johnny's scoot. Two rings. Three rings. Four. And then, distant, almost lost in static, but sounding like the voice of an angel bent down from heaven all the same, he heard Steve's flat Central Texas drawl. Hello? You? Boss? He drew in breath through his nose and hawked back blood, ignoring the pain, wanting to clear his voice as much as he could. Steve! Steve, I'm in trouble! I'm in bad trouble! There was a heavy crackle of static in his ear, and he was sure he'd lost Steve, but when it cleared, he heard, Hear you! What's... Another crackle. It almost completely buried the next word, but Johnny thought it might have been trouble. I hear you. What's the trouble? God, let that not just be wishful thinking. Please, God. The cop had stopped kicking sand again. He stepped away for another critical look at his handiwork, then turned and began to plod back toward the road, head down, hat brim shading his face, hands plunged deep into his pockets. I'm west of Eli on Highway 50, he said. More sweat ran into his eyes, stinging. There's an RV pulled off the road a little further up from me. There's a cop, not a state cop, a townie, I think, but I don't know which one. He was talking faster and faster as the cop got closer and closer. Soon he would be babbling. Take it easy. He's still 100 yards away. You got plenty of time. For the love of God, just do what comes naturally. Do what they pay you for. Do what you've been doing all your life. Communicate, for Christ's sake. But he had never had to do it for his life, and if the cop looked up out of his head-down plod and saw him, he was crouched down, but the phone's antenna was sticking up. Of course, it had to be sticking up. He took my bike, Steve. He took my bike and drove it out into the desert. He covered it up with sand, but the way the wind's blowing, it's out in the desert, a mile or two east of the RV I told you about, and north of the road. He swallowed. Steve! Steve, are you there? No, he wasn't. There was only one communication bar showing in the phone's display window now, and no one was there. He had lost the connection, and he'd been concentrating so hard on what he was saying that he had no idea when it had happened or how much Steve might have heard. Johnny, are you sure you got through to him at all? That was Terry's voice, a voice he sometimes loved and sometimes hated. Now he hated it, hated it even worse for the sympathy he heard in it. Now the cop was only 50 yards away. Johnny shoved the antenna down with the heel of his left hand, flipped the mouthpiece closed, and tried to drop the phone back into his right pocket. The flap was closed. The phone fell into his lap, then bounced to the floor. He felt around frantically for it, at first finding nothing but crumpled papers. His fingers closed on something narrow, not what he wanted, but even the brief glance he gave it before tossing it away chilled him. It was a little girl's plastic barrette. Johnny's hand found a nest of styrofoam coffee cups, and amid them, his phone. He seized it, dropped it in his jacket pocket, and pushed the snap closed. The cop opened the driver's side door, leaned in, and stared through the mesh between the front seat and the back.
"You scared?" the cop inquired. "Tell me the truth, Lord Jimmy. I'll no lie. Talk."
"Of course I'm scared."
"Good." He dropped behind the wheel, took off the hat, looked at it. "Doesn't fit," he said. "Folks singing bitch ruin the one that did. Never sang leaving on a fucking jet plane either."
"Too bad," Johnny said, not having the slightest idea what the cop was talking about.
"Lips which lie are best kept silent," the cop said,
tossing the hat that wasn't his over into the passenger seat. It landed on a tangle of meshy stuff that appeared studded with spikes. The seat, bowed into a tired curve by the cop's weight, settled against Johnny's left knee, squeezing it.
"Sit up!" Johnny yelled. "You're crushing my leg! Sit up and let me pull it out! Jesus, you're killing me!"
The cop made no reply, and the pressure on Johnny's outraged left leg increased. He seized it in both hands and tore it free of the sagging seat back with an indrawn hiss of effort that pulled blood down his throat and started him dry-heaving for real.
"Bastard!"
Johnny yelled, the word popping out in a red-misted coughing spasm before he could pull it back. The cop seemed not to notice that either. He sat with his head lowered and his fingers tapping lightly on the wheel. His breath was wheezing in his throat, and for a moment, Johnny wondered if the man was mocking him. Then the cop picked up something which had been lying beside him on the front seat, an old-fashioned shotgun with a double-trigger setup. He looked at it fixedly.
"You have never written a truly spiritual novel," the cop told him.
He spoke slowly, enunciating each word with care.
"You mock the God who created you, and by doing so you mortify your own pneuma and glorify the mud which is your sarx. Do you understand me?"
Without looking up from the wheel, he placed the double barrels of the shotgun on his right shoulder and pointed them back through the wire mesh.
"Answer me," the cop said. His voice was dark and brooding.
"Yes," Johnny said in a trembling voice.
"Pneuma is the old Gnostic word for spirit. Sarx is the body. You said, correct me if I'm wrong, just not with a shotgun, please don't correct me with a shotgun, that I've ignored my spirit in favor of my body, and you could be right, you could very well be." "Don't toady to me," the cop said wearily. "That will only make your fate worse."
He licked his lips. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to."
"Sarx is not the body. Soma is the body. Sarx is the flesh of the body. The body is more than the flesh that makes it. Is that so hard for an intellectual such as yourself to
to understand? I never thought of it that way. Oh, please. Even a spiritual naif like you must understand that a chicken dinner is not a chicken. Pneuma, soma, and his voice had thickened, and now he was hitching in breath, trying to talk as a person only does when trying to finish his thought before the sneeze arrives. He abruptly dropped the shotgun under the seat, gasped in a deep breath, and let fly. What came out of his mouth and nose was not mucus, but blood and red filmy stuff that looked like nylon mesh. This stuff, raw tissue from the big cop's throat and sinuses, hit the windshield, the steering wheel, the dashboard. The smell was awful. The smell of rotted meat. Johnny clapped his hands to his face and screamed. There was no way not to scream. "That was Sark's," the cop said, and started the engine. "You might want to keep it in mind, I'd say, for your next book, but I don't think there's going to be a next book. Do you, Mr. Marinville?" Johnny didn't answer, only kept his hands over his face and his eyes closed. The stench of what that man had sneezed out. He's dying. He's got to be dying. That's infection and internal bleeding. He's sick. His mental illness is only one symptom of something else, some radiation thing, or maybe rabies, or... "Oh, you'll learn, Lord Jim," the cop said, turned back toward him. He saw gray eyes staring from the rearview mirror. One was filmed with blood. "I'm taking you to the classroom," the big cop said. "School will be in shortly." He made a right turn, the cruiser lifting onto two wheels and then settling back. It headed south toward the cracked bulwark of the open pit mine and the town huddled at its base. Steve Ames was breaking one of the Five Commandments, the last one on the list, as a matter of fact. The Five Commandments had been given to him a month ago, not by God, but by Bill Harris. "All these commandments are thou shalt nots, and I don't expect you to have any trouble remembering them," Harris had said. "First, they shall not drink with him. He's been on the wagon for a while, 5 years, he claims, but he stopped going to AA, and that's not a good sign. Second, thou shalt not score drugs for him, not so much as a single joint. Third, thou shalt not score women for him, and he's apt to ask you, particularly if some good-looking babes show up at the receptions I'm setting up for him along the way. As with the booze and the drugs, if he scores on his own, that's one thing, but don't help him. Fourth, thou shalt not cover up for him. If he starts boozing or drugging, particularly if you have reason to think he's doing coke again, get in touch with me at once. Do you understand? At once." "I understand," Steve replied, and he had, but that didn't mean he would necessarily comply. He had decided he wanted this gig, in spite of the problems it presented, but that didn't mean he was going to sell his soul to keep it, especially not to a suit with a big gut and the voice of an overgrown kid who has spent too much of his adult life trying to get some payback for real or imagined slights he had suffered in the elementary school playground. "The fifth and final commandment," he had said, "thou shalt not pick up any hitchhikers in thy truck. Neither male nor female shalt thou pick them up, but especially not female." Which was probably why Steve Ames never hesitated when he saw the girl standing beside the road just outside of Eli, the skinny girl with her nose bent and her hair dyed two different colors. He just pulled over and stopped. She opened the door but didn't get into the cab at first, just looked up at him from across the map-littered seat with wide blue eyes. "Are you a nice person?" she asked. Steve thought this over and then nodded. "Yeah, I guess so," he said. "And, you're not like a crazy serial killer or anything?" "No, but Jesus Christ, you'd think I'd tell you if I was?" "I'd probably see it in your eyes," the skinny girl with the two-tone hair told him, and although she sounded grave enough, she was smiling a little. "Enough with the questionnaire, lady. You want to ride or not? I gotta roll my wheels." In truth, he was a lot closer to the boss than the boss would maybe approve of. He was 70 miles back instead of 150, but what the boss didn't know wouldn't hurt him. "You'll do, I guess," she said, hopped up into the cab, and slammed the door shut. "Well, thank you, Cookie," he said. "I'm touched by your trust." He checked the rearview mirror, saw nothing but the ass end of Eli, and got back out on the road again. "Don't call me that," she said,
It's sexist. Cookie is sexist? Oh, please.
In a prim, little no-nonsense voice, she said, Don't call me Cookie, and I won't call you Cake.
He burst out laughing. She probably wouldn't like it, but he couldn't help it.
He glanced at her and saw that she was laughing a little, too, and slipping off her backpack, so maybe that was all right. He put her at about 5'6" and skinny as a rail, 100 pounds max, and probably more like 95. She was wearing a tank top with torn-off sleeves. These gave an awfully generous view of her breasts for a girl worried about meeting Ted Bundy in a Ryder van. Not that she had a lot to worry about up there. Steve guessed she could still shop in the training bra section at Walmart if she wanted to. On the front of the shirt, a black guy with dreadlocks grinned from the middle of a blue-green psychedelic sunburst. Bent around his head like a halo were the words, Not gonna give it up.
You must like Peter Tosh, she said. It can't be my tits.
I worked with Peter Tosh once, he replied. She was looking at him with frank amazement.
Whoa, cool. What were you, a roadie?
Then, yeah. Later on, I was a guitar tech. Now I'm...
Yes, that was a good start, but just what was he now? Sort of demoted to roadie again. Also part-time shrink.
Now I'm into something else. What's your name?
Cynthia Smith,
she said, and held out a hand. He shook it. Her hand was long, feather-light inside of his, and incredibly fine-boned.
I'm Steve Ames.
From Texas.
Yeah, Lubbock. Guess you heard the accent before, huh?
Once or twice.
Her gamine grin lit up her whole face.
You can take the boy out of Texas, but...
He joined her for the rest of it, and they grinned at each other, already friends. The way people can become friends for a little while when they happen to meet on American back roads that go through the lonely places. Cynthia Smith was clearly a flake, but Steve was a veteran flake himself. You couldn't spend most of your adult life in the music business without succumbing to flakedom, and it didn't bother him. She told him she had every reason to be careful of guys. One had nearly torn off her left ear, and another had broken her nose not so long ago.
And the one who did the ear was a guy I liked, she added. I'm sensitive about the ear. God knows why.
He glanced across at her ear. If you're really sensitive about it, you could grow your hair out and cover it up, you know.
Not happening, she said firmly and fluffed her hair.
The half on Steve's side was green. The other half was orange.
My friend Gert says I look like little orphan Annie from hell. That's too cool to change.
Not gonna give them curls up, huh?
She smiled, patted the front of her shirt, and lapsed into a passable Jamaican imitation.
I go my own way, just like Peter, Mon.
Cynthia Smith's way had been to leave home and her parents' more or less constant disapproval at the age of 17. She had spent a little time on the East Coast and then had drifted back as far as the Midwest, where she had gotten sort of clean and met a good-looking guy at an AA meeting. The good-looking guy had claimed to be entirely clean, but he had lied. The good-looking guy had come home one night, fucked up on crystal meth, and had apparently decided he wanted Cynthia's left ear as a bookmark. She had gone to a shelter, gotten a little more than sort of clean, even worked as a counselor for a while after the woman in charge had been murdered and it looked as if the place might close.
I got a lot of my confidence back while I was there.
She was looking out the window at the passing desert and rubbing the ball of her thumb pensively along the bent bridge of her nose.
In a way, even the guy who did this helped me with that. So last month I finally wrote home to my folks. I thought when they wrote back, if they ever did, they'd be righteously pissed. My dad, especially. He used to be a minister. But the letter I got back was pretty great. I called him. We talked. My dad cried.
So you're going home, huh? Return of the prodigal cookie.
She gave him a look. He gave her a grin. Sorry.
Yeah, sure you are. Anyway, that's close.
Where's home?
Bakersfield. Which reminds me, how far are you going?
San Francisco, but I can't promise to take you that far. This gig is a little weird.
What is the gig? She asked. I mean, this doesn't look big enough to be a band truck. Are you touring with a folkie this time? Gordon Lightfoot, someone like that?
Steve grinned.
My guy is sort of a folkie, I guess, only he plays his mouth instead of a guitar or a harmonica.
That was when the cellular phone on the dashboard gave out its strident, oddly nasal cry.
Himeep, himeep.
Don't say a word, he told her, as the phone himeeped a third time.
You might get me in trouble if you do, okay? Himeep, himeep.
She nodded. The first thing Steve was aware of when he put the phone to his ear was how heavy the static was. He was amazed the call had gone through at all.
Hello? That you, boss?
Steve! Steve, I'm... trouble. Bat. What's the trouble? Were you in an accident? What's up, boss? Say again.
Crackle, zit, crackle.
Johnny, hear me? Yes, I hear you.
Shouting into the phone now, knowing it was totally useless, but doing it anyway.
What's happened to you?
No answer for so long. He was positive this time he had lost Marinville. He was taking the phone away from his ear when the boss's voice came through again, impossibly far off, like a voice coming in from another galaxy.
West, Eli, Iffy.
No, not Iffy, Steve thought, not Iffy, but 50. I'm west of Eli on Highway 50. Maybe that's what he was saying.
RV pulled off the road, a little further up.
And that was all. Steve yelled Johnny's name into the phone half a dozen times, but only silence came back. He used the name menu button to bring up JM in the display window, then pushed send. A recorded voice welcomed him to the Western Roaming Network. There was a pause, and then another recording told him that his call could not be completed at this time.
God damn it! It's bad, isn't it?
Cynthia asked. Maybe, he said, and then shook his head, impatient with himself.
Probably. That was my boss. He's up the line somewhere. He's riding a Harley. He...
Big red and cream bike?
She asked, suddenly excited.
Long gray hair, sort of like Jerry Garcia's?
He nodded.
I saw him this morning, way far east of here, she said. I was eating breakfast, and I saw him out the window. I thought he looked familiar.
He's a rider. Steve looked at the speedometer, saw he had the panel truck up to 70, and decided he could let it out just a little more. He's crossing the country getting material for a book. Anyway, he's had an accident. At least I think that's what's happened. She made no comment about how fast he was going, but when the rental truck hit 85 and the frame began to shake, she fastened her shoulder harness. By now he had told Cynthia the basic facts of his employ. He made reservations, checked routes, vetted sound systems at the places where the boss was scheduled to speak. He stayed out of the way so as not to conflict with the picture the boss was painting. Johnny Marinville, the thinking man's lone wolf, a politically correct Sam Peckinpah hero, a writer who hadn't forgotten how to hang tough and lay cool. The panel truck, Steve told her, was empty except for a long wooden ramp, which Johnny could ride up if the weather got too foul to cycle in. But there was another reason for the ramp as well, and for the tie-downs Steve had installed on the floor of the van before setting out. Johnny Marinville might wake up one morning and simply find himself unwilling to keep riding the Harley, or incapable of it.
I've heard of him, Cynthia said, but I never read anything by him. Nice bike, though, and the guy had great hair. Rock and roll hair, you know?
Steve nodded. He knew. Marinville did, too. When they were 60 miles west of the point where Steve had lost contact, he began slowing the truck a couple of miles an hour for each mile traveled. No police cars had passed them in either direction, and he supposed that was good. He said so, and Cynthia shook her head doubtfully.
It's weird, is what it is. If there's been an accident where your boss or maybe someone else got hurt, wouldn't you think a few cop cars would have gone past us by now?
I guess so, yeah.
He glanced at his watch and saw it was 5:45. The shadows had drawn long across the desert, but the day was still bright and hot. If Marinville was out there, they would see him.
I see something, up there!
The girl's voice was excited but controlled.
See? Could that... Aw, shit, no. That's way too big to be a motorcycle. Looks like a motorhome.
He said there was an RV off the road a little farther up. I heard that part quite clearly.
He slowed the rider truck to 30, then, as they approached the RV, to walking pace. Cynthia had unrolled the passenger window and was halfway out of it, her tank top riding up to reveal the small of her back and the ridge of her spine.
Anything? He asked her. At all?
Nope. I saw a glint, but it was way out on the desert floor, a lot farther than he'd have gone if he'd cracked up.
Probably the sun reflecting off the mica in the rocks.
Uh-huh. Could have been.
Then he got a really good look at the RV.
Oh, hey, what's this?
He asked, speaking more to himself than to the girl.
Guy must have run over some nails in the road or something. Tires look like they're all flat.
Yeah, so how come yours aren't?
By the time it occurred to him that the people in the RV might have been public-spirited enough to pick up the nails, the girl with the punky two-tone hair was out of the cab and walking up to the RV, hallooing. Well, she knows a good exit line when she gets one off, give her that, he thought, and got out on his side. Wind struck him in the face hard enough to rock him back on his heels, and it was hot,
like air blown over the top of an incinerator. "Steve, come over here. I don't like this." She was standing by the side door of the RV. It was unlatched, banging back and forth in the wind a little, even though this was the lee side and the steps were down. At the foot of the stairs, half buried in sand that the wind had blown beneath the RV, was a doll with blonde hair and a bright blue dress. He opened the unlatched door and poked his head into the RV. It was brutally hot, at least 110 degrees. "Hello? Anybody?"
"Don't bother."
Cynthia had picked up the doll and was brushing sand from its hair and the folds of its dress.
"If the girl who owned this doll was around, it wouldn't be lying out in the dirt. I practically guarantee you that. The question is, why didn't she take it with her when she and her folks left? Or at least toss it back inside?"
She opened the door, hesitated, went up one of the two steps, hesitated again, looked back at him.
"Come on."
She walked into the RV's cabin. Steve went the other way into the driver's area, ducking his head so as not to bump it. On the dashboard in front of the passenger seat were three packs of baseball cards, neatly sorted into teams: Cleveland Indians, Cincinnati Reds, Pittsburgh Pirates. Across the bottom of Albert Bell's card was this: "To David, keep slugging, Albert Bell." And another from the Pittsburgh pile: "See the ball before you swing, Dave. Your friend, Andy Van Slyke."
"There was a boy, too," Cynthia called. "Unless the girl was into G.I. Joe and Judge Dredd and the Motor Cops, as well as dollies in blue dresses."
"Yeah, there's a boy," Steve said, putting Albert Bell and Andy Van Slyke back into their respective decks. "His name is David."
"How in the hell do you know that?"
"Learned it all watching the X-Files."
He picked up a gas credit card receipt from the wad of papers jammed into the dashboard map receptacle and smoothed it out. The name on it was Ralph Carver, the address somewhere in Ohio.
"Dad's Ralph Carver. They hail from Wentworth, Ohio."
She came forward, the doll curled against one mosquito bump breast.
"Where did they go?"
"Nearest town to get help," he said. "Probably someone gave them a lift. You remember from your map what's around here?"
"No. There is a town, I think, but I don't recall the name. But if that's what they did, why didn't they lock up their place when they left? I mean, all their shit is here."
She saw something in the map holder, something that had been revealed when he stirred the crammed-in papers and plucked out a dollar sign money clip that looked like real silver. There were bills folded into it.
"How much?" he asked.
40 or so," she said. "The clip itself's probably worth 3 or 4 times that much. Tell you what, Pilgrim, this smells bad."
He turned for the door.
"Time for the cops?"
Cynthia asked.
"Soon. First, I want to walk a mile of back trail, see if I can spot any sign of my boss."
"You mean to drive the truck back? I can do a mile by the odometer, give you a finishing line to shoot for."
"Can you turn it around without getting stuck?" he asked.
She gave him an annoyed look.
"Course."
"Well, 1.5 miles, okay, just to be on the safe side."
"Okay."
She started toward the Ryder truck, then turned back to him.
"I just remembered the name of a little town that's close to here," she said, and pointed east. "It's up that way, south of the highway. Cute name. You're going to love it, Lubbock."
"What?"
"Desperation."
She grinned and climbed up into the cab of the truck. He walked slowly east along the shoulder of the westbound lane, raising his hand in a wave but not looking up, as the Ryder truck with Cynthia behind the wheel rumbled slowly past. Up ahead, Cynthia swung wide, then turned the bright yellow truck so it was facing back west again. She did this with an economy Steve wasn't sure he could have matched himself, needing to back and fill just a single time. She got out, started walking toward him at a good clip, hardly looking down at all, and he had time even then to be moderately pissed that she should have found what his instinct had sent him out here to look for.
"Hey,"
she said. She bent over, picked something up, and shook sand off it. He jogged to where she was standing.
"What? What is it?"
"A little notebook," she said, and held it out. "I guess he was here, all right. J. Marinville printed right on the front, see?"
"How come this didn't just fly away in the breeze?"
"Pure luck. It blew against a big rock, and then sand covered the bottom half. If he'd dropped it 6 inches to the right or left, he'd probably be halfway to Mexico by now."
"What makes you think he dropped it?"
"Don't you?" she asked.
He opened his mouth to say he really didn't think anything, at least not yet, and then forgot all about it. He was seeing a glint out in the desert, probably the same one Cynthia had seen while they were coming up on the RV,
only they weren't moving now, so the glint was staying steady. He was running out into the desert, running toward the glint, before he was even aware he meant to do it.
"Hey, don't go so fast," she sounded startled. "Wait up!"
"No, stay there," he called back. He sprinted the first 100 yards, keeping that star point of sun directly in front of him, and then a wave of dizziness hit and stopped him. He bent over with his hands grasping his legs just above the knees, convinced that every cigar he had smoked in the last 18 years had come back to haunt him. When the vertigo passed a little, and the padded jackhammer sound of his heartbeat began to diminish in his ears, he heard a distinct but somehow ladylike puffing from behind him. He turned and saw Cynthia approaching at a jog, sweating hard but otherwise fine and dandy.
"You stick like a booger on the end of a finger," he panted as she pulled up beside him.
"I think that's the sweetest thing a guy ever said to me. Put it in your fucking haiku book, why don't you? And don't have a heart attack. How old are you, anyway?"
He straightened up with an effort. "Too old to be interested in your giblets, Chicken Little, and I'm fine. Thanks for your concern.
Well, can I suggest we walk the rest of the way? Whatever that thing is, it's not going anywhere."
"I know what it is," he said, and trotted the last 20 yards. He knelt before it like a primitive tribesman before an effigy. The boss's Harley had been hurriedly and indifferently buried. The wind had already freed one handlebar and part of another. The girl's shadow fell over him, and he looked up at her, wanting to say something that would make her believe he wasn't completely freaked out by this, but nothing came. Steve grabbed the handlebars and tugged. Nothing. He wasn't surprised. It was a pretty feeble tug. He suddenly realized something that was interesting in a horrible sort of way. It wasn't just the boss he was worried about anymore. No, sir. His concerns had widened, it seemed. And he had this feeling, this weird feeling as if...
"Steve, my nice new friend,"
Cynthia said in a little voice, looking up at him from the little bit of fuel nacelle she had uncovered.
"You're probably going to think this is primo stupid, the sort of thing dumb broads are always saying in lousy movies, but I feel like we're being watched."
"I don't think you're being stupid," he said. "I feel that way, too."
"Can we get out of here?"
she asked, almost pleaded. She wiped sweat off her brow with one arm.
"Please?"
He stood up and they started back. When she stuck her hand out, he was glad to take it. A howl rose in the distance, wavering. Cynthia's grip on his hand tightened enough for Steve to be grateful that she bit her nails.
"What's that?" she whimpered. "Oh, my God, what is it?"
"Coyote," he said, "just like in the Western movies. They won't hurt us." "Let up a little, Cynthia. You're killing me." A second howl came, wrapping itself lazily around the first like a good barbershop tenor doing harmony. They reached the truck. Cynthia got in on the passenger side, giving him one quick nervous smile over her shoulder as she hauled herself up. Steve walked around the truck's hood, realizing as he went that the sensation of being watched had slipped away.
"What now?" Cynthia asked.
"Well, let's find this town you mentioned. What was it?"
"Desperation. It's east of here."
"Navigate for me, will you?"
"Sure," she said, and then touched his arm. "We'll get help. Even in a town that small, there's got to be at least one cop."
David Carver saw it while the woman in the blue shirt and faded jeans was finally giving up, huddling back against the bars of the drunk tank and holding her forearms protectively against her breasts as the cop pulled the desk away so he could get at her. One of the shells had fallen off the desk. It was lying on its side against the far left-hand vertical bar of his cell. David glanced at the old guy who was in the cell with him, wanting to see if the old guy had also noticed the shell. So far as David could tell, he hadn't, although he had finally gotten off the bunk and come to the cell bars. Instead of yelling at the woman who had tried her very best to blow his head off, or maybe hurting her for it, the cop was giving her a brief one-armed hug.
"I'm not going to kill you, Mayor."
The cop looked around as if to ask the remaining three Carvers and the white-haired guy if they could believe this crazy lady. His bright gray eyes met David's blue ones, and the boy took an unplanned step back from the bars. He felt suddenly weak with horror. The cop's eyes were empty. So empty, that it was almost as if he were unconscious with them open. This made David think of his friend Brian and his one memorable visit to Brian's hospital room last November. But it wasn't the same, because at the same time the cop's eyes were empty, they weren't. There was something there, yes, something, and David didn't know what it was or how it could be both something and nothing. The cop looked back at the woman called Mary with an expression of exaggerated astonishment.
"Gosh, no," he said. "Not when things are just getting interesting."
He reached into his right front pocket, brought out a ring of keys, and selected one that hardly looked like a key at all. It was square, with a black strip embedded in the center of the metal. He poked this into the lock of the big cell and opened it.
"Hop in, Mayor," he said.
She ignored him, looking instead at David's parents. They were standing together at the bars of the little cell directly across from the one David was sharing with white-haired Mr. Silent.
"This man, this maniac, killed my husband. Put his arm around him like he did me just now, and shot him 4 times.
"He killed our little girl," Ellen Carver told her. And something in her tone struck David with a moment of utter dreamlike unreality. It was as if the two of them were playing Can You Top This?
"That's enough chit-chat," he said.
He sounded like the world's kindliest grandpa.
"Hop into your room, Mary mine, into your gilded cage, my little blue-eyed parakeet."
She looked at him a moment longer, then tore her eyes away and walked into the cell. Her face shivered as she went, then broke apart as the cop slammed the cell's barred door behind her. She threw herself onto one of the 4 bunks at the rear, put her face into her arms, and began to sob. The cop stood watching her for a moment, head lowered. Then he walked across to where David was standing. The white-haired man backed rapidly away from the bars as the cop came, retreating until the backs of his knees struck the edge of the bunk and he folded down to a sitting position.
"Having fun, David?"
the big blonde cop asked. His eyes seemed to be expanding, turning into bright gray ponds filled with light.
"Are you filling this interlude measure for measure?"
It came out a dusty croak. He licked his lips and tried again. I don't know what you're talking about."
"Don't you? I wonder about that."
The expression on his face seemed to be one of genuine puzzlement.
"Who are you, boy?"
"I'm David Carver," he said.
"Yes, I'm sure that's true. But, little Dave, who made thee? Canst thou say who made thee? Talk."
"I guess my mother and father made me," David said. "Isn't that the way it works?"
"A boy who understands the birds and bees. Wonderful. And what about my other question, Trooper? You having any fun?"
"You killed my sister, so don't ask stupid questions."
"Son, don't provoke him," his father called in a high, scared voice. "Oh, I'm not stupid," the cop said, bending his horrid gray gaze even more closely on David. "I may be a lot of things, but stupid in one of 'em. I know a lot, Trooper. I do. I know a lot."
"Leave him alone," David's mother screamed. "Haven't you done enough to our family? If you touch him, I'll kill you."
The cop paid no notice.
"I've got eagle eyes, David, and those are eyes that see the truth from afar." "You're quite a one, aren't you?" the cop breathed. "You're quite a one indeed. Yes, I think so."
"Think whatever you want. Just don't think about me thinking about the shotgun shell." The cop's eyes widened slightly, and for a hideous moment, David thought that was exactly what the cop was thinking about. Then a coyote howled outside, a long, wavering, lonely sound, and the cop glanced in that direction. The thread between them, maybe telepathy, maybe just a combination of fear and fascination, snapped. The cop bent to pick up the shotgun. David held his breath, fully expecting him to see the shell lying on the floor off to his right, but the cop did not glance in that direction.
"Don't go away, David,"
he said in a confidential just-us guy's voice.
"We got a lot to talk about. That's a conversation I'm looking forward to, believe me, but just now I'm a little busy."
He walked back toward the center of the room, head down, picking up shells as he went. The first 2 he loaded into the gun. The rest he stuffed absently into his pockets.
David dared wait no longer. He bent, snaked his hand between the two bars on the left side of the cell, and grabbed the fat green tube. He slipped it into the pocket of his jeans. The cop who had killed Pye picked up the last shell on the floor, took a brief look under the desk, then straightened and snapped the shotgun closed with a single flick of his wrist. David had watched him closely through the picking up process, trying to get a sense of whether or not the cop was counting the shells. He hadn't thought so until now. Now the cop was just standing there, back to, head down. Then he turned and strode back to David's cell, and the boy felt his stomach turn to lead.
"Are you thinking about God?" the cop asked. "Don't bother. There's no God in desperation, baby boy. Out here, there's only kind of luck."
That seemed to be it. The cop walked out of the room with the shotgun now riding under his arm. David could hear his booted feet thudding down the stairs, shaking the whole building. The boy stood where he was for a moment, knowing what he had to do now, absolutely had to do, but reluctant to do it in front of his parents. Still, there was no choice, was there? And he had been right about the cop. The big man hadn't exactly been reading his mind like it was a newspaper, but he'd been getting some of it. He'd been getting the God stuff. He turned and took two slow steps to the foot of the bunk, and then very slowly sank down on his knees. He folded his hands on the rough woolen blanket, dropped his forehead softly onto them.
"David, what's wrong with you?" his mother called. "David!"
"There isn't anything wrong with him," his father said,
and David smiled a little as he closed his eyes. Their voices were distant now, fading, but before they went out entirely, he heard his dad say,
"Not fainting, praying."
No God in desperation? Well, let's just see about that. Then he was gone, no longer concerned about what his parents might be thinking, no longer worried that old Mr. Whitehair might have seen him filch the shotgun shell and might tell the monster cop what he had seen, no longer grieving for sweet little Pye, who had never hurt anyone in her life and hadn't deserved to die as she had. He was in the black now, blind but not deaf, in the black and listening for his God. Like most spiritual conversions, David Carver's was dramatic only on the outside. On the inside, it was quiet, almost mundane. He had found God, that was all, and God had found him. In November of the previous year, David's best friend had been struck by a car while riding his bike to school. Brian Ross was thrown 40 feet into the side of a house. On any other morning, David would have been with him, but on that particular day, he had stayed home sick, nursing a not-too-serious virus. It had been his idea to go and see Brian in the hospital the next day, after calling the hospital all on his own that evening and ascertaining that his friend was still alive.
"Honey, I understand how you feel, but that's really a bad idea," his father had said. "It's best if you remember Bri the way he was when you saw him the last time. Understand?"
"Yes, but I can't do that. I have to go see him. If you don't want to take me, that's okay, though. I'll take the bus after school."
"Brian's parents won't let you in," Ellie had said. "I've known Mark and Debbie for years. They'll know better than to let a little boy look at another little boy who's dying."
"I called him after I called the hospital and asked if I could come see him," David said quietly. "She said she was glad I could come say goodbye. She said they're going to turn off the life support stuff this weekend after his grandparents come to say goodbye, and she was glad I could come first."
The following day, Ralph took the afternoon off from work and picked his son up at school. David had been standing at the curb with his blue excused early pass sticking out of his pocket. On the way, David tried to prepare himself for what he was going to see.
"Don't be shocked, David," Mrs. Ross had said on the phone. "He doesn't look very nice. We're sure he doesn't feel any pain. He's down much too deep for that. But he doesn't look very nice."
"Want me to come in with you?"
his father had asked outside the door of the room Brian was in. David had shaken his head. He was still powerfully in the grip of the feeling which had more or less swallowed him since his pallid mother had given him the news about the accident, that feeling of being guided by someone more experienced than he was, someone who would be brave for him if his own courage faltered.